Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. It is our intention to continue offering these audio recordings free of charge. However, if you would like to donate to support our cause in keeping our facility open in Nashville, you can do so via the Venmo app by sending a donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can find us online at our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, and click the Donate tab. We'll sit a little bit later on. I wanted to talk about the topic of wise concentration tonight, which is one of the factors of the Buddha's Eightfold Path. It's the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, wise concentration. And before the group, when I was reflecting on the topic, I was thinking about how this used to be my least favorite thing to talk about. I think I was, first of all, scared of it because it felt really serious and technical. Right? And I also felt like an imposter because I had very little access or ability to focus and concentrate. Right? I felt like the Buddha was my school teacher calling me out, like I couldn't pay attention or concentrate or focus. And I think this is very common for a lot of people when they're first coming into meditation, maybe even if you've been here a while, it's feeling like the mind is the master. You know, our ability to focus in or tune in to the basic experience, like we said just a moment ago, into the sounds or the breath or into the body, it's quite difficult because the mind, the thought stream, is so powerful. Its momentum is powerful, its stories, emotions are captivating. And so I know for me, I felt like an imposter trying to teach this topic, wise concentration, because I didn't feel like I was very good at it. Now, I think there are a couple reasons why I felt that way, a couple reasons why I felt like I was an imposter. One is that I viewed concentration or focus more as a mental quality than a skill. Right? Like the mental quality, what I mean by this is like being concentrated. Like having a mind that's concentrated. In positive psychology, they coined the term being in a flow state, which is actually like a mental state. And they define it, I'll read it, it's interesting. It's a mental state of operation in which a person performing an activity is fully immersed in a feeling of energized focus, full involvement, and enjoyment in the process of the activity. So I'll read it again because it's interesting. This is what I used to think of when I thought about the Eightfold Path factor, the eighth factor of wise concentration. I thought it was this mental state of being focused or in this flow state, which is a mental state of operation in which a person performing an activity is fully immersed in a feeling of energized focus, full involvement, and enjoyment in the process of the activity. Now, well, it's true that concentrating leads to concentration. I think I overemphasize the emphasis on being concentrated. I felt like I was not concentrated often, and I forgot that concentration, or really focus, is a skill. The more that I practice it, the more that I develop it, the more often I am concentrated. The more often my mind is collected and stable. Right? So you see, it's a thing with language, I think, a little bit, which is the problem with language, but is that I thought more of, and I think we do this with meditation in general, we think of meditation as an experience rather than a training. So if I'm not having the experience I think I should be having, or have a mind that's collected or calm, then I feel like I'm not meditating, which is horribly inaccurate and detrimental to our practice. I think this is the tendency of our mind to look a lot at what we can't do rather than what we can do. I can focus. I can't always be concentrated. I can't always be in a state of flow or concentration, but I can practice training my attention to be more focused. So I'm going to give a definition for focus that I really like. It's from a meditation teacher named Shinzen Yang. I added a part to it, but I think it helps to give us an understanding of what is focus as a skill, as a practice. And he says it's an ability to find, place, and sustain your attention where you consider it to be relevant at a given time. Right? He just uses the words find and place. But I think to really focus, we also want to sustain, to keep our attention where we consider it to be relevant. And we'll talk about this more later, but where do we find our attention? We find our attention in all sorts of places. In the future, in the past, in some fantasy, some daydream. Sometimes our attention doesn't even seem to be here, zoned out or checked out. So we find our attention all sorts of places. During meditation, you can observe that. Fundamentally, mindfulness is a science of attention training, of finding the attention wherever it is, observing it without judging it, just noticing it, no big deal, and being able to, if you want, to practice letting go of this incessant clinging and preoccupation with our thoughts. So focus is a skill, it's a practice of or an ability to find, place, and sustain your attention wherever you consider it to be relevant at a given time. So I didn't know that when I first started. I thought that I was just supposed to be in some state instead of practice a skill. The other thing that I think caused me to feel like an imposter in teaching wise communication and also practicing it wise concentration and also practicing it is that I didn't quite understand, I think, what the Buddha really meant by wise concentration. What does that mean to the Buddha? This is the problem with language is we've translated the word sama samadhi, which is the Pali Sanskrit terms that the Buddhist discourses were eventually recorded into. It was an oral tradition for a couple hundred years before it was recorded on paper. And the words that are more closely linked to probably what the Buddha meant was sama samadhi. And so sama means something like wise. So here we're talking about wise concentration, sama samadhi. But it actually means something more like complete, or harmonious, or imbalance. Right? So that gives me a better picture. It gives me kind of like a feel. And that's the cool thing about a lot of these old Sanskrit terms or Pali Sanskrit terms, is they have more of a feeling to them rather than an academic, like dry textbook type of feeling. So it means to be imbalance, or complete, or harmonious. Sama precedes every factor of the Buddha's Eightfold Path, that word, sama. Samaditti means wise view. Samasati means wise mindfulness. Sama samadhi means wise concentration. Or, in this case, balance. It's said that the Buddha taught a path, a spiritual path, of practice. Not an experience, but a practice that is the middle path. A path between extremes. And so how this helps me in thinking about wise concentration is what he means more is it's a practice of balancing our concentration. Right? So there, he's not saying that eventually you get the secret teaching of how to concentrate the correct way, right? Or that we eventually achieve a state of a concentrated mind. All those states of concentrated mind do arise as we practice, but he's saying rather that you can practice an ability to balance your focus through mindfulness, through meditation. So the word samadhi, here I've just let it be what it's normally translated as, concentration. But the root word is samada, which means to collect or to bring together. To collect or to bring together. So this is one of the reasons why I felt like an imposter, is when I heard the word concentrate, I thought about all my experiences in school of teachers telling me to pay attention, pay attention, pay attention. Right? And I was diagnosed with ADD when I was a kid and took medicine for it, and so I believed I had this attention deficit. I just literally believed that I did not have enough of it. I was like, nope, I don't have attention. I don't have concentration, I can't do it. So I thought that it was something, you know, it's a funny term to pay attention. It's like I'm going to buy it somehow, right? But really what mindfulness is all about, it's not about paying attention, it's about training attention, right? And so to break this down a little bit, the word samadha, where it comes from, the root word means to collect, right, or to bring together. So what it really means is a collectedness of mind or a unification of mind. So if we put these two things together, putting sama and samadhi together, instead of wise concentration, we actually get a balanced way of collecting the mind. Sounds a lot more gentle, right? Sounds a lot less about performance and exactness and rigidity, and it sounds a lot more about practice and patience and something that I could maybe do, find a balanced way through practice of collecting my awareness. So now I think is the important question. Why? Why do we want to do that? This is the answer that a lot of teachers struggled with when they told me to pay attention. Why? Why the fuck do I want to learn about trigonometry or whatever the hell you're teaching right now? My mind is far more interesting to me than algorithms. So why? Why do we want to sit down and practice collecting our mind? The first is because the attention is a mental faculty. It's in Buddhist psychology, in the Abhidhamma, which is a collection of discourses that was written a couple hundred years after the Buddha's death, they talk about attention being a universal mental factor, which means that it is present in every moment that you are awake. So here's why. Because you have it all the time, but you don't always know where it is. So we have an attention that is addicted to the thought stream. I like to say that we have this thought stream. Somewhere it says you have between 50 to 70,000 thoughts a day. I don't know if that's true or not. The more and more I practice mindfulness, the more and more I think that is probably true. Right? Just watching in 20 minutes how much the mind wanders, it's like, okay, maybe at least 20,000 thoughts a day. So we have this thought stream. The mind is a sense door. I like to talk about this a lot because I think it helps to put in perspective why we practice mindfulness, is that the mind is a sense door, meaning thoughts arise and pass through this door. We don't really have any control over the mind's thoughts. But we can choose how much we pay attention to them, how long we pay attention to them. Once we pay attention to initial thought, whether we want to go to the next thought or invest more time in our thoughts. So we can choose to find our attention in our thoughts and make the decision to break the addiction to the thinking mind, to tell the mind if we want to, not right now. Right? Like I'm driving down the road and tripping about work or finances or whatever it may be, I can make the decision, how much time do I want to invest in this thought? That's very powerful. It's so simple, but it's very powerful. There's a lot of power in having that ability, that opportunity to tell the mind in a gentle way, a non-judgmental way, not right now. Setting a healthy boundary with the mind door. Right, it's like the Buddha actually says, I think this is really beautiful because things that I find like to be true about my practice, he said 2,600 years ago. And he talks about mindfulness as being like a watchman at a tower. If you think about like a castle and having a watchman, this is me trying to avoid the prison metaphor. But anyway, being at a castle and having a watchman, watching what comes in and out of the gate. Mindfulness watches the mind door. And he actually talks about it like that. It kind of guards the mind from what comes in and how long it stays in and so on and so forth. So one of the reasons why we want to practice a balanced way of collecting our mind, of training our attention, our focus, our ability to find, place, and sustain our attention, is because it helps us to disengage from the obsessive, discursive, ruminating thoughts in our mind, the thought stream. Another reason why we practice training our attention through mindfulness is because it supports a calm and tranquil mind. So you'll notice that as you meditate, if you've been meditating maybe not even that long, right? I don't even want to put a time limit on when things happen, because again, it gets us caught in that, when am I going to have that experience? But as you meditate, as you practice, you'll start to notice that your ability to settle in, right? And especially if you meditate for a little bit longer, like 20 minutes or 30 minutes, the mind starts to settle as the attention starts to focus on a primary object, and we'll talk about this later, an anchor or a home base, like your breath. You're giving the mind an object to focus on that it can access, that it can take refuge in or seek shelter in. So you're actually giving the mind a safe place to rest. Instead of the attention, I talked about this last week in Zen Buddhism, they talk about the monkey mind swinging from one thought to another thought to another thought endlessly. We tell the attention, hey, here's the breath, it's already here. You don't have to do anything with it, but feel into it. And then you connect, you find your attention, you place your attention on the breath, you sustain your attention with the breath. Yeah, and sure, 10 seconds later, it's off again. Of course. We find the attention again, we place the attention, we sustain the attention with the breath. Over time, as we keep doing that, that's simple, I call it observing, returning, over and over again, the mind starts to settle. And as the mind starts to settle, as the mind starts to get a sense of tranquility or ease, we can develop more clarity. We can see where the attention goes next. Right? I like to give this example. It's a little bit abstract, but I find that these practices are very experiential. Sometimes it helps to have metaphors for them because of that. It's like giving the attention a home base, like your breath, is like literally giving a 12-year-old kid, your attention, a place to come home to. Right, so if you have this little kid and it knows its parameters, it knows the neighborhood it lives in and how far it can go and when it needs to be back for dinner, so to speak. If you give it some support, right, it can explore with a lot less anxiety. You notice that when you observe your thoughts, when you first sit down in meditation, there's all of this judgment and restlessness. It's like even just noticing that my mind's wandering is like an insult to my mind. Right? It's like if I try to investigate my thoughts or explore them, I get too analytical, or I try to pick them apart, or I try to figure out, am I supposed to be doing this? I don't even think I'm supposed to be meditating this way. Am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? The mind is agitated and obsessed and caught in restlessness and worry. So when we start to kind of be able to set a boundary with the mind and say, not right now, and give it an object like the breath, very simple, to focus into, to breathe and to feel the breath, it helps to settle the mind, and then we can start to watch it and have more clarity. Right? Like when every second my attention is being stirred around by the thought stream. You know when you get caught in like a riptide in the beach, or if you've ever been swimming across a river and the water kind of pummels over you, it's hard to orient yourself or know where the hell you are in space and time when that happens. So when we give ourselves a stable object like the breath, the body, sound, something that's physically present, we'll talk about this later, as a home base, we can then watch our mental patterns with more of an objective vantage point as an observer, right? Because I have a home. This is my home, my breath. This is my space. Mind, thought stream comes in, grabs the attention. I see where the kid goes, right? I'm able to watch the mental patterns and habits and thoughts. This helps us to develop what's called sampajanya, which I talked about last week, clear comprehension or clear seeing of our thoughts, insight. The whole point of practicing mindfulness, not to have a calm, tranquil mind, but to be able to develop this other aspect of insight. To have a calm or tranquil enough mind, a settled enough mind, to be able to clearly see the mind. You know, it's like sometimes they say absence makes the heart grow fonder, although as I say that, I realize that there's a lot of attachment in that. This ability to separate ourselves from something helps us to have a clearer perspective on it a lot of the time. You know, like when you're in a relationship that's coming to its end, if you've ever been in one of those. After the fact, we're able to have a lot more clarity about the relationship, right? While we were in it, it was harder to see clearly. And so as we set a boundary with the mind and connect and sustain with an anchor like the breath, we have more clarity, more separation, more seclusion from the mind. So some of that's a little bit abstract. It doesn't really matter. We're going to get into the form of the practice, how to practice. To review really quickly, the Buddha taught a balanced way of collecting the mind, sama samadhi, a balanced way of collecting the mind. The core skill of how to balance and collect the mind is focus, and focus is an ability to find, place, and sustain your attention wherever you consider it to be relevant at a given time. So that's the skill. Why we want to practice that skill is because it helps us to break the addiction to the thinking mind, to get out of the thought stream, because it also supports more tranquility, more of a restful mind, and it also helps to develop clear seeing because we have space, we can step back and observe. So where do we start with developing wise concentration? I won't talk a lot about this, but it's very important because I think sometimes I forget that the Buddha taught a holistic spiritual practice, much more than just mindfulness. He taught a way of living. He taught a way of living. He taught a path of using mindfulness to check into whether we're living with intention in our life, in our relationships, in our jobs, in how we speak and act and move through the world. So part of what supports our mental clarity and mental stability, our collectedness of minds, part of what supports that is our environment and the activities that affect our mental stability. What we do affects our mind. Everything we do affects our mind. Everything. This is the concept and idea of karma. And karma, I don't want to get into it too much because it's a whole different talk. But karma was an idea that was around at the time of the Buddha. So this idea sometimes in our Western world of karma being this like metaphysical from life to life, like whatever you reap, you sow over the course of many lives, that idea is more attributed to the Vedic traditions that were around at the time of the Buddha. What the Buddha emphasized in karma is he took that idea of cause and effect, basically. Whatever you do has an effect. Whatever you think has an effect. Whatever you speak has an effect. Whatever you do through your behavior and action in the world has an effect. He took that and applied it to this moment. What you do right now has an effect. He says famously in the Dhammapada, I read it last week, I can't quote it from heart, but he says that all experience is preceded by your mind, made of your mind. If you speak or act with a corrupted mind, right, then that corruption gets stronger. If you speak or act with a skillful mind, with a compassionate mind, then that mind gets stronger. And so the interesting thing about the Buddha's teaching is he's not teaching morality, not at all. He's not actually telling you how you should live your life. Thank God. How much does that work, right? What he is saying is that whether you are conscious of it or not, your thoughts, your speech, your action, they're having an effect on you. He's saying, do what you want with that, but it's true. Whatever we think gets stronger. Whatever ways we speak affect our relationships, our dynamics in our relationships, however we act, those behaviors get stronger. So we have to look at how our environment and our actions affect us. And some of the simple ways, again, I'm not going to talk about this a whole lot, but some of the simple ways to look at this is one of the factors of wise intention that the Buddha offered is the practice of renunciation, which is kind of a weird word. The Pali Sanskrit term for renunciation is nikama. Nikama means not needing anything extra. So why do we have such busy minds? Here's my point. Why do we have such busy minds? It's because we live busy lives. It's that simple. Right? Why are our minds restless? Because our lives are restless. No judgment. Mine's restless. Yours is restless. They're all restless. It's hard not to, right? This world that we live in seems to demand that we be restless. The Buddha calls this perpetual wandering, right? That we keep seeking refuge in stimulation. And he calls this stimulation, he says that there's this world of busyness offers three things: a gratification, a danger, and an escape from it. He says, in this world, in this life, we can find the gratification in the busyness, which means it's fun to have fun. It's fun to do things. It's fun to drink coffee with friends and eat things and listen to music and look at my phone every 5 seconds. It's just fun. That's why we do it. There's gratification. And I think the Buddha is genuinely validating that. I don't think he's like, you know, poking fun at us. I think he's saying, no, there's genuine gratification. He says, but there's danger in it. And the danger in it is that we get addicted. We get hooked into the busyness without even seeing it. The biggest area of my life where I notice this is when I go on meditation retreat for like a week or even just a couple days, even sometimes just a day retreat, right? And how quickly these old kind of these, the momentum, it's not even an old anything, it's really just this momentum where my attention has become caught up in the busyness, how quickly the attention gets back to it. I talked about a couple weeks ago this thing that I like to talk about, ghost phone syndrome, where you go on retreat, you can't talk on your phone, you don't talk to anyone or write anything, and I'll notice when I sit down on my bed at the end of the night, feeling for my phone. And it happens actually all day long the first few days of retreat. I sat a month retreat in New Mexico and I watched this happen. And about 2 or 3 weeks into the retreat, I'm talking very little stimulation, external stimulation on the retreat. I was in the middle of the Carson National Forest, not cars around for miles, right? About 2 or 3 weeks into the retreat, it took me to maybe have a whole day where I didn't have that tendency to reach for my phone. So here's the thing, is that if we want to have some ability, a balanced way of collecting our mind. Part of keeping our mind in balance and collected is to try to practice living with more simplicity as a practice, not as a commandment or a judgment or just another way to look at our spiritual practice as a thing we're failing at. Right, but I try to look at, like I said earlier, what can I do instead of what am I struggling to do? What am I doing? What can I do? And one of the things my teacher told me to do early on is to try to take a day a week where I practice renunciation, where I let go of some of the things that I use the other days of the week. So on Sundays, although I did use it once today, telling on myself, I try to not use social media. Right, I try not to listen to some of my like entertainment podcasts, and you know, I try to meditate longer than I normally would, and practice more of a simple life. Take my dog for a walk without the earbuds, and real simple stuff, right? So there are little things that we can do or practice. Nikama, renunciation, means not needing anything extra. Just looking around our lives, what's extra? They say that the Buddha calls this the result of practicing renunciation. He calls it the joy of renunciation. Isn't it funny how when I have to let something go, I feel like I have to let something go? And what happens when you let something go is it frees up space. You're no longer, like literally in that sense, using that hand anymore. And so now you have more space. And more space means that there's more freedom to move around, more flexibility. So it's one of the things we can look at, how our environment and activities affect our mental stability. Also, and I definitely won't talk about this that long, but looking at our... In Buddhist practice, we as lay practitioners, meaning non-monks and nuns, people that are living in the world with jobs and money and that type of thing, we try to practice what's called the five training precepts, which are ways to look at not causing harm through our behavior. And I won't go into them, but that's another way to have some mental collectedness and stability. Jack Kornfield likes to say it's hard to meditate after a long day of stealing, lying, killing. Right? If we're causing harm, obviously, I hope none of us are killing people, but if we're, you know, stealing, being dishonest, not being careful with our sexuality, some of these things, if we're taking things that aren't offered to us, those things come up when we meditate, right? Restlessness, remorse, regret. Healthy emotions, thankfully we have them, but we feel less of those emotions when we don't do things that make us feel regret. Again, there's that kind of cause and effect. All right, so now I want to talk about, well, one other thing real quick is another thing we can do to have more of a collected mind is to commit to a daily meditation practice, right? To view meditation as a practice rather than an experience. And I just like to offer this. I tend to struggle as a teacher doing this. My teacher was really good at it. He used to be kind of like a coach. He would kind of encourage me and push me in areas that helped me, actually. And I would push and encourage you. If you've been coming around for a while and you come over here once a week, you know, or twice a week, to start practicing at home. Even if you don't, even if you just are coming for the first time tonight, to start practicing a meditation practice. Maybe at the beginning you just try to do like 3 to 5 days a week or something. Right? But setting a commitment can help us to, or a recommitment. I know for myself, I always am recommitting to my meditation practice. Right? I'm not meditating every single day. I'd like to. I know it's good for me at this point, especially dedicated so much of my life to it, right? But I have days where I wake up early and I get involved in my day and, you know, I may have that 15, 20 minutes I could sit down and sit, but instead I want to answer an email or do something else. So committing to a routine can help too. Setting up a space and place in your house can help. Right? If you have a physical location, you're more likely to see it. You're more likely to go there. If you have a goal, you're more likely to try to do it. But give yourself a short, attainable goal, something simple. Right? We want to set ourselves up for success. And then practice, I call it the no matter what mentality. No matter what, reach your goal that day. If tomorrow your goal is to meditate 15 minutes, do it. Just do it, no matter what. If you forget to do it at the time you said you're going to do it, if you remember when you're in bed at the end of the night, get your ass out of bed and go sit for 15 minutes. That's what I used to do. I used to do these 90-day kind of commit to sit. We used to do them here, too. We would have a text group, and everyone would commit to it. This positive peer pressure to help us be accountable to our practice. So now getting into the bread and butter, and then we'll do some of the practice together, is in meditation, in formal meditation practice, how do we start to develop this ability to find, place, and sustain our attention? Finding a posture, a way to sit that is purposeful. So I don't talk about posture a lot, mostly because I think that the important thing here is to sit in a way that feels comfortable. Everyone has a different body, right? So if I was to come in and say, sit like this, that may not be appropriate for everyone. You know, I wasn't raised to sit on a cushion with my legs crossed. I thought that if I was going to get enlightened, I had to. And in traditional Andrew fashion, I didn't ask anyone. I went and sat on the cushion with my legs like this, never having sat like this, and suffered through an immense amount of pain for years, pretty much, until my body adjusted. And it's like, okay, I can do this, and this is now very comfortable for me. I do think that there is some benefit to practicing putting ourselves in postures that, you know, like this posture helps to kind of help my knees feel connected to the ground. It does help tilt the pelvis forward a little bit. It helps sit the body upright. So I think there is some just general, you know, benefit to this posture. You can sit on your knees. That's called a Zen or Zazen type of style of meditation, which is also a great way to sit. Sitting in chairs. This is the way that I was raised. Sitting in a chair, perfectly acceptable. I always joke and say I'm going to write my first book is going to be Enlightenment from a Chair. Right? You can totally, it's totally a spiritual posture and totally appropriate to sit in a chair and meditate. Right? When I'm on retreat, I usually have a cushion. I also have a chair. If I'm going to sit for a little bit longer, of course, some of it is trying to work with physical discomfort and the sensations that come up. But we want to, in general, be very kind to our bodies and sit in a way that's comfortable, that's meaningful, purposeful, upright. In the actual meditation practice, having a meditation object, like an anchor or a home base, like I talked about earlier, some forms of meditation use visual objects. There's actually a somewhat lost tradition in Theravada Buddhism, in our lineage of Buddhism, of using visual objects. This is called a kasina practice, kasina, K-A-S-I-N-A. Sometimes you hear about this in other meditation traditions, like focusing or directing your visual sense, your eyesight towards like a flame or a clay disc, a colored disc or something like that. So there's that. It's an option of a mental object. During the heart practice meditation, some of you all have been here and done the metta practice or the compassion practice. What you're doing when you're practicing the heart practices is you're using sometimes visual, like imagining someone, a benefactor, a family member, a difficult person, to offer compassionate phrases to. Right, so you may use a visual, you also use words sometimes for the phrase like, may you be at ease, may you be at peace. And during your meditation, you're visualizing or imagining a being, someone, and you're offering these phrases. You're saying them silently to yourself, may you be at ease, may you be at peace. And you're also trying to develop a mental state or a feeling, which is the meditation object. You're trying to generate an attitude of loving kindness. It's a mental state or quality of a kind, friendly, gentle relationship. So during the heart practices, you develop wise concentration, is what I'm trying to say. That it's a concentration practice just as much as it is a cultivation practice. So when your practice is dry, meaning if you don't feel a lot during the heart practices, you're still collecting your attention, your mind. What we like to focus on are physical and spatial sensory objects, which is just a fancy way to say simple rudimentary objects that are present. I like to say, how do you know that you're here? If the goal is to be present and aware, how do you know that you're here? And how do you notice when you're not here, or when your attention gets swept into the thought stream or a daydream or starts to zone out? How do you know that you're here? You're hearing sound. If you have that ability, you're hearing sound. Or you're feeling the sensation of breathing in the body. Your body is breathing. Or another anchor object you can focus on is the weight of your hands, the contact of your body. I call it mindfulness of gravity. Just feeling the weight of the body. My favorite meditation instruction is, you're sitting, know that you're sitting. Very simple. So where's your home base? Where's your anchor? As you're sitting, know that you're sitting. I, as a teacher, tend to be pretty liberal with how I guide meditation and encourage people to practice it. Meaning, I don't care if you focus on your breath, the sounds, the weight of your body, anything that's physically or spatially here. Sound is more spatial, right? It's this wide kind of field. It's a sense of being in a space. The breath is more of a physical sensation. It's a feeling. You have access to it. The weight of the body is a sense of a form, right? You can feel the gravity or the contact. Sitting, know that you're sitting. Hearing, know that you're hearing. Breathing, know that you're breathing. So that's the primary object of focus. Now, here's what I want to talk a little bit about, is mindfulness of breathing. And then we're going to do the mindfulness of breathing practice, which is really foundational. It's a part of the first foundation of mindfulness. Your breathing process is an automatic process. You don't have to do it. Your body, you can do it. You can have agency over your breath. You could hold your breath if you want to. If you hold your breath long enough, your body's going to breathe for you. You pass out, your body will say, fuck you, I'm taking over. This guy's an idiot, right? Breathing is an automatic process. So while we're practicing mindfulness of breathing, try to just work with this. It's just kind of a shift in perspective here. Don't try to put your attention on the breath. Don't try to do breathing. Don't try to make breathing happen. Try to allow the body to feel the breath that's already happening. Allow the body to feel the breath that's already happening. Allow the body to breathe itself, is the way that I like to put it. Allow the body to breathe itself. You notice it's a little bit different. Instead of me trying to find the breath and hammer it down and, you know, figure it out or whatever my mind tries to do with my breath or control it, instead, I just see if I let my body breathe itself, if I can tune into the sensations that are already present. Traditionally, there's a way of practicing mindfulness of breathing where you want to find a location in your body that you connect with and feel your breath most easily. For some of us, this may be the air at your nostrils. For some of us, this may be the rise and fall of your abdomen. Or it may just be more of a full kind of, sometimes you feel it at the nostrils, sometimes you feel it at the abdomen. Doesn't really matter, but you can play around with it. So I like to say that you can be more zoomed out with your anchors and just feel your body sitting, notice the sounds. Or you can zoom in a little bit more. You can feel the process of breathing. And then you can even zoom in a little bit more and feel the breath at your nostrils or the air at the rise and fall of your chest or stomach. It doesn't matter whether you zoomed out or zoomed in. Here's the thing. Over time, as you practice zooming in more, your collectedness of attention probably get a little bit more collected. The more zoomed in over time, the more collected the mind can start to become. But if you start to get restless or agitated, it's too much, zoom back out. Does that make sense, those terms, zooming out, zooming in? So I like to say, if you're gonna go for it and you're starting to feel your breath at your nostrils and then you start to get restless and you're like, I can't get it, I can't figure it out, you're too zoomed in. I call it meditator's claustrophobia. I learned that term from my teacher. Too claustrophobic, zoom out. Just be with the sounds, chill. Relax the body, be with the sounds. So the key to the practice is to become intimate with the feeling and the knowing of the breath in the body. As you feel the breath, you know the breath. But you know, here's a little bit more subtle. So if you're practicing mindfulness of breathing, you'll notice that very subtly your attention will start to check out. So you'll still think you're feeling and knowing the breath, but there will be maybe like a second or two, or sometimes a minute or two, where you think that, but all of a sudden you realize, I'm actually not feeling and knowing. And so the breath is waiting for you. It's always waiting for you. That's the good thing. You don't have to go find it. It's always waiting for you. It's already here all the time. Sometimes I like to talk about practicing mindfulness in terms of observing and returning, like I talked about earlier. So your breath is your primary object. Everything else that comes up, thoughts, your mood, your attitude, feelings, whatever else comes up, is a secondary object. Right? So that means that there's no grounds for bad meditating. There's just primary object, secondary object. If you notice doubt in your mind, like, I'm not doing this right, doubt is a secondary object. Notice the doubt. Observe the doubt. See how the doubt is. See what it's like to have a mind that has doubt. Doesn't, probably an unpleasant feeling. Probably a lot of other thoughts. If we can just note the doubt and observe the doubt, and then we can come back to the breath, the doubt can come, the doubt can go. So everything in terms of primary or secondary objects, that sometimes helps, or just this practice, the way I like to put it, observing and returning. And the last thing I want to talk about is the idea of foreground and background awareness. So the way to talk about this is to think about, there's kind of a distinction or a difference between attention and awareness. Sometimes even myself, meditation teachers will mistakenly use these words interchangeably, attention and awareness. I like to think of awareness as more of a wide field. So awareness is like if you're on top of a hill, or rather, even better yet, like you're at the Grand Canyon and you know they have those little like sightseeing binoculars. Awareness is like you're not at the binoculars, you're standing back from it, you're just looking over the Grand Canyon, you're seeing all of its beauty. And in looking over the Grand Canyon, you see birds, you see hikers down in the valley, you see water, you see the weather moving in and moving through, you see all the tourists moving around. So you see all of the things. But your attention's not really focused on any one of them. You're kind of in this wide observer awareness. So in your awareness, there are only six things that are possible to happen. Thoughts, sensations, which are physical feelings, sights, smells, tastes, sounds. Six things. Now, the thoughts can be really nuanced. There can be like emotions that also have a physical component. Don't worry about that. What we're saying here is as you back up from your experience, as you just observe this wide field in the awareness, there are thoughts that come and go, feelings that come and go, sights, smells, tastes, sounds. Attention is like walking up to the binoculars, putting the quarter in, and focusing in on something. Right? So with mindfulness, check this out. It's like foreground and background awareness. So it's like you're tuning into the breath. The breath is your meditation object. It's in the front. so to speak. It's not literally in the front, but it's kind of in the front. This is interesting because in the Buddha's own instructions on mindfulness, he says, the meditator, having gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, sits down, folds their legs crosswise, which basically means has a posture, sets her body erect, upright, and establishes mindfulness in front of her. Establishes mindfulness in front of her, bringing the attention to the breath. And then he goes on to say, mindful she breathes in, mindful she breathes out. It's that simple. So as we're tuned into the breath, what you'll see is in your peripheral awareness, in the background awareness, thoughts will come and go. They'll maybe grab your attention and take your attention to the thought. Right? But you just notice the thoughts, the feelings, the other things that are coming and going in the background. When your attention shifts and gets caught in one of the thoughts or one of the feelings, it's okay. Just acknowledge it, notice it, and return your attention back to the breath, letting everything else fall into the background. One way I like to talk about this, because it's hard, because it's not linear, it's more spatial. It's like if you've ever been reading a book and someone's talking in the other room. Right? Like you're reading and you're maybe focused on the material, and then there's that moment where your attention starts to pick up the conversation and to tune into outside of the room, the background. Right? And we have to make that choice. There's that decision to find the attention, to place the attention, to tell the mind gently and non-judgmentally, this is a big part, not right now, no big deal, but not right now, and bring the attention back to the book, the breath, and listen back in. Does that make sense? So that sometimes helps people, is thinking about either primary, secondary object, observe and return, or foreground, background. I want to do a little bit of the practice together. We'll meditate for about 15 minutes, which will give us about 15 minutes for discussion. The last thing I want to offer is sometimes you can use silent labels. Silent labels in the mind to help to direct your attention to the breath or to observe whatever else comes into your awareness. Silent labels. So I call these periodic labels, meaning I don't label quickly when I label. I label every once in a while. So this is called noting practice. Sometimes I just note with the word wandering when I notice my attention's wandering. So you see, it makes it like a simple, rudimentary, just like wandering. Whatever the mind's doing, whether it's planning or daydreaming or whether I'm checked out, doesn't matter. It just gets the label wandering. So sometimes I just like using labels on the secondary object, and then I'll come back to the breath and just feel the breath in my body. Sometimes you can use silent labels on your breath. I like to just label because I like I said, not a lot of labels, just every once in a while. I'll just label my out-breath with the word out as I breathe out. So silently in my mind, I'll just say the word out. And then feel my breath. So the word directs me to the feeling. Right? If I notice my mind wandering, the label directs me to notice. When we're noting, we're not analyzing, we're just noting, noticing. Use that only if it's helpful, and I could give a whole talk on noting, which I'm not going to do. But just know that that's an option. Here's how we're going to do the meditation practice tonight. I'll guide the beginning of it. I'm going to offer you options. You can focus into the sounds, your breath, the weight of your body. Then we're going to practice mindfulness of breathing. I'm going to offer a couple instructions. Then we'll just sit in silence and practice together for the last probably 10 minutes of the meditation.